and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. A wildfire in the mountains north of L.A. has rapidly spread to over 9,000 acres, and some 54,000 people are under evacuation orders or warnings. CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti.
Despite hundreds of firefighters on the ground and an arsenal of planes dropping massive amounts of water and retardant, embers pushed by 30-mile-per-hour winds are still igniting trees and thick brush.
Nashville police are investigating a deadly shooting at Antioch High School. Police spokesman Don Aaron says the shooter is identified as a teenage male.
One of the persons that the 17-year-old shot, a female, was transported to Vanderbilt University Medical Center and is deceased.
Another student was injured. Up to 1,500 active duty troops prepare to head to the southern border to strengthen U.S. presence. CBS's Omar Villafranca.
Military planes, including C-17s and C-130s, will be used to deport migrants out of the country, starting with 5,000 from El Paso and San Diego.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Community Stories is taking a holiday break for the month of January. I'm your host, Melissa Kay, and the show will be back in February with more stories from your community.
The Bucks game called off due to weather. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks game tonight against the Pelicans has been called off due to the winter weather in New Orleans. The city hit in some areas with up to a foot of snow, making travel for fans in Louisiana treacherous. So the Bucks are returning to Milwaukee. They'll host the Miami Heat at 6:30 tomorrow night at Fiserv Forum. And the NBA says the game against the Pelicans will be rescheduled at a later date. College basketball. Badgers returning after losing at UCLA 85-83. Marquette with an easy win over Seton Hall, 76-59. NFL, the Chicago Bears introducing their new head coach, Ben Johnson, who has been the offensive coordinator of the Lions the past three seasons.
I've got tremendous amount of respect for the coaches and the players in this league. Dan Campbell, Kevin O'Connell, you're talking about two guys that are up for Coach of the Year awards. And to be quite frank with you, I kind of enjoyed beating Matt LaFleur twice a year.
That's the Bears' new head coach, Ben Johnson, with sports on Mike Clemens.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Mike Siegel. Hey, Mike.
When I look back at all those years on the road and going on two-lane highways in northern Wisconsin, in the dead of winter, could have been like 10 below outside. One deer jumps out in front of me. I was like, I'm done here.
You're in a ditch, and they're not going to find you for 3 days. Dead deer carcass over there and a dead comedian carcass.
Holding his date book.
Somebody might want to call and cancel him at Zanies next week in Chicago.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Fantasy Island. It's evidently what we've become as my Red Hats. I don't know where this is coming from. I haven't been able to find it yet, but the thought that Donald Trump didn't put his hand on the Bible because something that's breaking some compact, we're destroying the corporation that is America, and a new world will be, just because he didn't put his hand on the Bible, a new world, a new country, new prosperity, new opportunity, new hope, a new vision for America. I know I shouldn't mock the dim, but holy, seriously, just because he didn't put his hand on the Bible, because, and there are some on the left who go, oh, if he put his hand on the Bible, he'd explode. Yeah, just stop. That is such an insignificant thing. It's ridiculous that it's even a thing. But the fact that everybody's spinning is, well, quite remarkable. Now, what President Trump did on day one was make the cost of insulin more expensive for people, because he undid Biden's cap. And on that front, I've had a couple people tell me, well, that's because he's got a better plan. He's got a better plan. There's something better coming. And I love the conservative optimism, I guess, in this moment. I love this kind of, tomorrow's going to be a better day, because we got a billionaire and all of his billionaire friends and a guy who's worth $500 billion. We've got them all now leading our government. boy. I'm rarely without words. But today I'm kind of without words because, you know, people who are struggling to make ends meet. And look, the anger is real. The prices are too high. The wages are too low. People are struggling to make ends meet, keep a roof over their heads. Rents are crazy. Car insurance is crazy. All of this stuff is crazy. Corporate America is robbing us blind. And now the people who are stealing from us, it's like putting Bonnie and Clyde in charge of Citibank. It's like the bank robbers now are, well, that's not, we've already done that. They're the CEOs. Never mind. There are no more Bonnie and Clydes. There are no more bank robbers. They just became CEOs. And they don't have to steal from the bank. They just steal from us, the people who put money into the bank. So I guess we've come full circle. But I got this fantasy email, and I've heard this a number of times, and I've kind of just, you know, I've dismissed it because it's ridiculous. But this fantasy that has been presented to me is now that Elon Musk is in charge, now that Doge Boy is at the top of the heap, you know, the president's right-hand man, that we're going to go to something called universal high income. Now, you may remember we had Andrew Yang on this program a long time ago where he talked about universal basic income to meet your basic needs, even though a grand a month was not going to get anywhere near there. Elon's talking about basic universal high income, everything you want, whatever you want. There'll be more goods and services. There'll be more everything. Glutton yourself to death because we have the land of plenty. We have so much. Now, what's interesting to me, and I guess the weird part, is the guy that Trump has nominated for Treasury Secretary is pushing tax cuts for Elon Musk, but not talking about minimum wage increases for workers. So I guess we're going away from trickle down. No, just give it to all of us. And once we have it all, because what Elon's talking about is straight up welfare. And yeah, I've heard him talk about this a bunch of times. And it's one of these things where you go, do you think everyone can live like you do? Do you think everyone's got the context to get, you know, government contracts just handed to them? Do you think everyone was born to the parents of emerald miners? Not miners. That's a misstatement. They weren't miners. It's not like they were down there with a pick and a shovel. They owned the mine. Other poor people went down and worked in the mine and created enormous wealth that they didn't get to keep. So excuse me if I'm a little leery of this fantasy that now that Elon Musk is in charge, we're going to have universal high income. Because here's the thing. This is the part that, you know, where the fantasy gets quashed. We are already the wealthiest country in the history of humanity. There's enough wealth right now to go around to make sure everyone has a roof over their head, food on the table, clothes on their back, opportunity at education, opportunity of healthcare. There's enough. It's just our billionaire and trillionaire friends are like, no, there's not. No, not for you. There's enough. We could pay workers better. We could raise the minimum wage. But as I said, Trump's nominee for Secretary of Treasury, no interest in raising the minimum wage, but interest in cutting taxes on the billionaires and in the corporations. I think that speaks a lot. Now, I go back to this fantasy, because I guess a lot of what you see on the right is fantasy. That this guy, you know, who has shown no inclination to care about working people in the past, in fact, has done his foolhardy best to screw them over every chance he gets, that somehow this is going to be the guy who leads us to the land of milk and honey. This is going to be, we're going to Nirvana. Utopia is just around the corner. And there'll be a giant T, a giant gold T. It's dangerously weird. But here we are. Now, the weird thing for me is that I watched the video, I watched the speech that Trump gave, and you pan through the crowd, and there are a lot of working class people in that crowd. A lot of people who you know spent money they really might not have had didn't have the disposable income to go there, but got there anyway. And we're left to not be able to go to the inauguration because, hey, we got to go inside because it's cold. Those people, they believe. They're the believers. They believe that this guy is going to somehow make their lives better. They've put faith in someone like Elon Musk, who is telling them, you're gonna live like me. You're going to all live like kings. It's kind of a religious argument if you stop and think about it. You know, when you go to heaven, everyone's going to be, you know, living high off the hog. But we're going to be able to do it here now because of well, our savior, Donald Trump and Elon Musk. But again, I come back to the weird part. Because for me, it's this, you're still cutting taxes on the very wealthy who have all they could ever want. If you really believed in this idea of universal high income, you would fight for stronger unions. You would fight for stronger minimum wages. You would fight for a better distribution of wealth, a tax code that actually got you to that place. Because our tax code used to be fairly progressive. The more you made, the more you paid. And the less you made, the more you got returned. It was a little progressive in that we redistributed a little bit. And people got a little bit more than they paid in to help them make ends meet. Because, hey, it's good for the economy. But it's also just right. That if you work hard and you play by the rules, you should get ahead. We don't have that tax code anymore. We have a tax code where if you can figure out how to cheat and hoard and pay enough attorneys to avoid paying taxes, then you're smart. I'm not seeing that kind of a tax code coming out of this administration that is going to help build that prosperity. I don't see anything that leads me in a direction that universal high income with all the goods and services we could ever imagine. Maybe I'm not able to envision what they're talking about. But what I see is I see them using our system of government to enrich themselves, to make their power greater, to make their wealth greater, to deregulate so that they can do more. It seems like a fantasy that you shouldn't have bought into. Want to hear your thoughts? You buying it? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Is Nirvana around the corner? Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we knew it was coming. You know, Monday, the executive order-a-thon. Did exactly what we thought he was going to do. He's going to go after workers, and in a big way. He was going to undo a lot of the Biden stuff that he thinks he can do. And look, hey, we're going to go after, you know, with executive order changing the Constitution. You know, some little thing. But the message that came out of it is the phrase that all of my red hat friends are saying, nothing is going to stand in our way. You know, no laws, no precedent, no Supreme Court, no American people. These are the words of the dictator. So day one dictator I see this going a little bit further. And here to share some thoughts on the executive order day of action and maybe what some of them were and why we should be some concerned, I've asked my good friend Colin Seeberger to come share some thoughts. Colin's a communication advisor there at the Center for American Progress. Not just an advisor, a senior advisor. But Colin, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So what we expected on day one?
You know, I guess they've been telegraphing their plans for quite a long time. We saw a lot of it laid out in Project 2025. We've heard a lot about what they would be pursuing on the campaign trail and throughout the transition. I guess the thing that really stood out to me is just the massive gulf between the campaign rhetoric and what we ultimately saw in terms of action yesterday. You know, there was a lot of focus throughout the campaign on needing to address the cost of living and that prices are too high. And yet yesterday we saw President Trump signed in an executive order to roll back an executive order that would cap the cost of generic drugs in the Medicare program at no more than $2. Who is it benefiting to make drugs more expensive? I'll give you a hint. They're doing quite well. It's Big Pharma.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, doing things like putting a moratorium on offshore wind. All that's going to do is drive up the cost of utilities, make it more expensive to pay your electric bill. And so, you know, all of this is just obviously a radical departure from the concerns that, you know, many Americans are you know, understandably sounding the alarm on in terms of the cost of living crisis. And yet we see, you know, Trump, you know, sounding off on that problem, but only making it worse in his actions.
Now, my red hat friends, because I brought this up, you know, right away, I say, hey, look, you know, already making things worse, as I am predicting he is going to do with his actions. And their response was, well, we had to get rid of the bad so we can bring in the good, because he's going to have something better. This blind faith belief that somehow whatever he's got up his sleeve, whatever's on those invisible documents that he doesn't have, that this is going to make life better. And look, I hope he does. I hope I'm wrong. I hope we go, you know what? If you need insulin, you get insulin. I hope that's where he's going. I don't think so, though.
I think it's understandable to be a little skeptical. I mean, it's incredible to me to listen to Donald Trump's inaugural speech yesterday talking about, you know, we need to put an American flag on Mars and suggesting that we have the money in the U.S. government to be, you know, playing space cowboy with Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, but we don't have the money to make it a little more easy on families to buy their groceries at the end of the week, or we don't have the money to, you know, help people be able to pay more affordable costs for childcare, things like that. It's just ridiculous. And I think it really speaks to who Donald Trump and his, you know, cabinet of, you know, some of the most wealthy people in this country who they're working on behalf of.
No, and it's an excellent
point. And it's
point.
Not the people whose programs that they want to take a, you know, take an axe to, whether it's healthcare or veterans benefits, food assistance. They've been laying out very clearly, you know, who they're planning to make foot the bill, and it's the middle class.
Well, it's the entire working class of this country who's going to take it on the chin. Because, you know, you made the point I made at the beginning, which is we have enough money to do the right things for people in this country. We have enough wealth in this country to pay workers a living wage, so we don't have to rely on the kind of welfare that Elon Musk is claiming he's in favor of. That we can distribute things a little bit more equal so that people can lead decent lives. But yet I saw nothing on Monday from Donald Trump or anyone there that tells me that that's on the agenda. In fact, what I keep hearing is we need more tax cuts for rich people and, well, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah, I saw nothing in there that actually supported organized labor. I saw nothing in there that, you know, is actually going to enhance American competitiveness and make it possible for us to bring more jobs back from overseas. That his own tax bill from his first administration helped facilitate the exporting of. So, you know, I think you're exactly right. I do think that, you know, one thing that we know with this president is there's oftentimes You know, a lot of doublespeak and a lot of saying one thing and doing something completely counter to it. And I think that's something that we're going to be watching very closely in the weeks ahead. But, you know, I think there's a reason why we have, you know, some of these folks who have been appointed to his cabinet are, you know, have sexual abuse backgrounds or other sort of indiscretions and personal qualities that are very unappealing. It's so that way people are paying attention to that. They're not paying attention to how, you know, he's working to screw over hardworking people in this country. And that ultimately is where we need to be keeping our focus.
And look, on day one, he said he was going to go after federal employees and did a hiring freeze and a return to the office kind of thing. And
yeah, Rick, I got a friend who was up for a new job at the VA and who was in the process of working to get that job, but they were still conducting his background check. And so he had not actually started yet. And he got notice this morning that he's not going to be able to have that job anymore.
Yeah.
And that's less money for him. It's less money for his family. It's less money for him to be able to get ahead. So,
and more importantly,
you know, these executive orders, they have real life consequences. Right. And I think that's the thing that I want people to remember.
No, and more importantly, and you know, I'm sorry for your friend, but you know, that was a job at the VA that they needed to get done because our veterans, you know, the people we put up on a pedestal and said, I mean, these are heroes, the people who answered the call when we pushed out in front and said, we're going to take care of you. That's us not taking care of them.
Yep. That's exactly right.
So also on day one, evidently we're going to isolate from the rest of the world. I guess we're pulling out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. We're, I guess, the WHO, the World Health Organization. Anything else we're pulling out of?
Yeah, those are the two big ones. You know, the Paris Climate Agreement, you know, is basically ceding all American leadership on solving this global problem. You know, we're only the wealthiest country in the history of the world. And now we are saying, oh, here, China, come eat our lunch on this. And, you know, we'll go ahead and cede, you know, our not just our responsibility, but, you know, our own leadership in developing the clean energy technologies that are going to help us curb climate change, you know, going forward. So, you know, we know that these, you know, that these efforts are really important because we've seen in, you know, such devastating ways, whether it is Asheville, whether it is the fires out in California, you know, we're seeing in such devastating ways that the consequences of climate change are compounding and they're making, you know, our communities more susceptible to ever more intense storms. And so let's be clear, you know, we can either take action right now or we're going to have to, you know, we're going to be spending a lot more money to rectify all of the devastation that climate change is going to bring to people if we don't wrap around our arms around us on the front end.
Well, disaster capitalism can be very, very lucrative depending on which side of the disaster you're on. There's always been a part of me that's the reason. But you brought up the fact that, you know, by pulling out of the international community, we're ceding some ground to China. And that was what Donald Trump's 4 years in office were really about, us pulling out of places like Africa and China running in to fill the void. And I fear that, I guess our leadership now is going to just be renaming, you know, the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America while China does, on the international level, eat our lunch. And I got a real problem with this kind of isolationism.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that people in this country, I think understandably, are feeling squeezed, right? And they want a government who is focused on you know, making it a little easier for them to get by. And they want a government that's going to invest in their futures. And that's why, you know, I think it's understandable for people to, you know, be expressing some desire for a recommitment from their government to their, you know, their own way of life and their own ability to get by. Yet, we know that that's not going to come if we completely isolate ourselves from the rest of the world, right? You know, Donald Trump has talked about imposing 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada by February 1st, right? These are tariffs that could end up massively increasing the cost of things that people really care about, like the cost of housing. If lumber is more expensive, you know, which is normally imported from Canada, it could be a lot more expensive to buy your groceries because Mexico actually produces a lot of the produce that we rely on in this country because of their warm climate, right? So, you know, there's a number of different ways that the American people could be really have the rug pulled out from under them, and have their lives, you know, a lot more stressful if they're having to spend a lot more money in order to just be able to provide for the basics.
No, I agree. But look, I'm a tariff guy. I believe that we can use tariffs in a way that benefit our strategic needs, protect you know, strategic interests. I'm not one of the knee reflexive kind of, oh my God, tariffs, no. If used as part of a bigger plan as a tool, yeah, I'm all in favor of it. But this kind of broad-based blanket kind of, it hasn't worked in the past, which is interesting because, you
know, it's haphazard.
You know, but it seems like, you know, Donald Trump read a book on President McKinley because obviously one of the orders, I guess, is to rename Denali Mount McKinley again. I guess we're going back to that. Really an important thing to do on day one. But it seems to me there's this kind of, you know, wanting to go back to that era that McKinley created. You know, the robber baron era of the 1880s and 1890s. It seems coincidental.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump talked about a golden age in his inaugural address. Sounds more like a gilded age to me, where the workers get, you know, take it on the chin, and you know, these you know, most wealthy people in the entire world are standing right beside him, you know, pulling the strings, telling him, you know, here's what we want, you know. We'll be friendly toward you. You just, you know, green light our mergers and acquisitions so we get bigger and bigger. You take a cop off the beat at the FTC. You, you know, completely deregulate as much as possible. And suddenly, who is it that's left holding the bag? It's the American people when, you know, the house of cards that they build comes falling down, right? We saw this in, obviously, in the Great Depression. We saw this in, you know, the 2008 financial crisis. And we saw it in 2023 with, you know, the small banks, you know, snowballing in emergency rescue. And, you know, we could be staring down kind of the same sort of basically too big to regulate sort of model for a lot of these big tech companies. If the plan that Donald Trump and his cabinet appointees, including the acting secretaries that he announced yesterday, end up actually executing on those plans. We know what they want to do. And, you know, we need to be, you know, on guard for what the damage is going to be for American people.
No, I agree. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, what's the way forward for Democrats? They don't control either the House or Senate, obviously not the White House. They seem to be lost on some messaging. And look, I look at the landscape of the media. It's all about, you know, Elon doing the salute or Trump not putting his hand on the Bible. I mean, we're chasing the laser pointer again and missing what's really important. Are we going to see a direction? Are we going to see a vision coming out of Democrats? And what are you guys advocating for them?
So I think that Democrats, they can't be distracted by the Gulf of America, the invasion of Panama or Greenland, right? They can't be distracted by those issues. Donald Trump has been writing checks that he can't cash on the economy. He promised that he's going to be able to bring down prices, that he's going to be able to, you know, solve the cost of living crisis, you know, like the snap of his fingers. That's not going to happen.
Right.
And Democrats have to be, they have to be relentless in holding his feet to the fire for making promises to the American people, not just that he can't actually achieve, but ones that he's actually even making worse. And I think that's going to do a lot to, really tease out the juxtaposition between the two parties and what they stand for and who they're fighting for. And I think that's really going to help the party find its footing.
There you go, Colin. I appreciate the thoughts as always. Good stuff. Look forward to having you back here again real soon. It's going to be an interesting ride for the next couple of years, but I appreciate the time.
Sure is. There is.
Good stuff. Colin Seeberger, Senior Advisor of Communications there at the Center for American Progress. You can check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Going to make it worse? Going to make it better? Are you one of those folks who says, yeah, get rid of that insulin bill because something better might be coming down the road? And I'll bet you're one of those people still waiting for it to rain, the rivers of golden honey that we were promised from trickle-down economics. Back after this.
Locally grown radio, WFHR. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Scattered flurries with clearing late, a low close to zero. Sunny and colder tomorrow, a high only of 10 above, but low 20s with sun Friday. Partly sunny but warm for January into the weekend, highs upper 20s. Currently 21 degrees.
You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but still, you shine at useless information. And WFHR and Culver's want to reward you.
Welcome back.
Join the morning show Fridays for a chance to win one value basket and a kid's meal. Be our next superstar with Culver's Star of the Day every Friday at 97.5 FM WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a lot of my labor friends are asking, hey, what's the way forward? Everyone's afraid with the new administration coming in that labor is going to be front and center under attack. Most of labor kind of did back Kamala Harris. So the thought is Donald Trump's going to go after them. How do we organize in the new world? I look at what they did in Colorado back in 2022. They passed this Colorado Collective Bargaining Act that gave the public sector employees in that state the ability to collectively bargain for the first time, I understand, in the state's history. And at the state level is where we're going to have to spend a lot of time. But this is kind of a big deal, this Collective Bargaining Act in Colorado. And this week, you had the biggest win in the history of this act. And that's why I have asked Catherine Lehman to come talk with us. She is the bilingual Pearl Program Coordinator with Boulder County. They have just won the biggest election under this legislation. That's why I've asked Catherine to come join us. Catherine Lehman, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So walk me through. How did we get here?
Yeah. So, I began with Boulder County about a year ago and right away joined in the efforts of our union organizing committee. Those folks have been working on this for some of them about 3 years now. So it's been a long time in the making. And this past week on January 16th, we finally won our election. So the Boulder County Employees Union under CWA, Communication Workers of America, will now represent 1,419 workers. We won the vote 442 to 221, so 2-1. Big victory, a lot of votes to count. It was a huge effort. It was a month and a half long election, all took place by mail. And we're absolutely thrilled. This is our kind of time to put our priorities into action as workers, our own priorities in our work here with Boulder County.
Sure. And to have some say in your day and maybe a push for a little bit better wages, hours, conditions, all of that stuff. The kind of things that built a prosperous working class in this history, in this country. So did the county put up a fight? Was this contentious? Under this law, are they able to do that? Walk me through some of that.
Yeah, great question. We're excited to be able to finally work together with the county at the bargaining table after this whole process. But yeah, we first filed our petition. You know, we collected our card signatures. We had a third of our bargaining unit sign cards in support of this. We filed that April 1st, and our election didn't start until mid-December. And a lot of that was due to kind of wrangling between the attorneys representing the county, our attorney from CWA, with negotiating together with the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment, CDLE. And you know, part of that, I think, also is that, as you said, we're the first large unit to go through this process under this law. So you know, a lot of that was kind of setting precedent for including all of, you know, almost all departments within the county. We had some questions over whether public health and housing and human services, because they are governed by their own kind of boards, whether they'd be included. And we pushed for everyone to be included that we could. Public health is a huge representation within our supporters. And in the end, yeah, we have this massive bargaining unit. We're so excited to have that kind of power in our numbers. But yeah, it was a long process. It was a long fight.
But, you know, overall, I mean, the reality is, you know, April to December, in the private sector, it's become much worse than that, which is why I do believe we need comprehensive labor law reform in this country. Not that we're going to see it in the next 4 years. But, you know, the reality of where we are is workers still need to be able to organize in the age of Trump. But here's the thing. On the federal level, during his inauguration, he put the target back on federal employees. They're going to try and fire people. They're going to try and do all kinds of things at the federal level. So seeing state level public sector workers going, hey, we need to protect ourselves, I think a good thing. But do you have any concern that that's going to trickle down from the federal level to the state level?
You know, I think there's always some concern about that. But, you know, here in Colorado, our governor has, at the very least, you know, tried to kind of position himself as and has done, you know, some decent stuff in terms of putting himself on the side of unions at times. And, you know, when we have our legal right here, we are, you know, we're prepared to fight for ourselves and advocate for ourselves, whatever kind of comes down from federal level.
Now, I want to go back to the state law, this Colorado Collective Bargaining Act, because, as I said before, I believe Colorado didn't have the ability for public sector workers to organize. There was no law that did this for them. They were able to pass a law and get this done. Because I do think a lot of what we're going to be needing to do over the next 4 years is going to be at the state level. Are you aware of how, you know, how this process went to get this, you know, what it took to get this law out of your governor and your state legislature?
Yeah, you know, I know that it was definitely a long process, and there was a lot of kind of back and forth. There was definitely some compromise that went into it. For example, you know, something that we intend to, you know, now that we have this union, we have this voice, intend to, you know, eventually push for example, this act does not include the right to strike. So the way that we, you know, need to potentially, hopefully not, you know, last, you know, we hope that negotiations will go great, but, you know, we have to find other creative ways to, you know, apply pressure if we end up needing to push back on things. So yeah, this law, you know, it came about with, you know, I know CWA was a big part of it. The general like labor movement here in Colorado really pushed for it and got state legislators to finally make it happen. But yeah, it also was a big process of compromise, and it's not perfect. And we're gonna keep trying to improve it.
Yes, but now this is the first major victory. Do we see this roll across the across the rest of the state to get more public sector workers the right to decent wages, hours, conditions, all of the things that being part of the labor movement brings?
I think that we do. Yeah, we really see this as precedent setting. Like I said, I think a lot of the delay that we saw was because the CDLE was so aware that this case is going to be the precedent for how this works in other places. And I think that, you know, our size, the size of our unit, the 2-1 victory, I think that is all absolutely on the way to inspiring this across the state for sure.
Now, we were talking before we came on air about your position. You're the bilingual PEARL program coordinator. What does PEARL stand for?
PEARL stands for People Engaged in Raising Leaders. My programming aims to encourage civic participation and diversify, you know, the faces of the people who have a seat at the table in county decision making. And I really see that as directly connected to my work advocating for a union and being part of a union as well. Participation in the decisions that control your life happens at work, it happens at home, it happens at the school board, it happens joining a county board. And so I see such a great kind of dovetailing here of the work I do for the county and what I'm doing winning this union with my comrades at work here.
Yeah, but I heard you use that D word. Which seems, I don't know if you noticed this week, a new guy took over in D.C. and that's one of the words going to be under attack. Is this one of the reasons that maybe a lot of your members joined the union because the fear of what could be, or was this aspirational? Hey, our lives are going to get better. I'm curious. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it's definitely got both. We are super hopeful for the kinds of things we can do to make work and life better for every employee at Boulder County. But yeah, absolutely. There's a sense of, you know, what can we do to protect ourselves in this time of kind of fear and uncertainty, especially those of us who care about, you know, the D word, diversity. And having a seat at the bargaining table at work and having a solid sort of sense of solidarity and a collective protection for all of us, the union is absolutely the way to feel a little more in control, right? A little more safe in under those conditions.
And not just protection for you, but also for the citizens of Boulder County. Because one of the things I love that you've mentioned a couple of times is doing the best that you can for the citizens of the county, doing your job. And one of the things that unions give workers the ability to do is to be empowered to do the best job that they can without fear of repercussion. You know, that I think is a big part of this as well, no?
Absolutely. This 100% enables us, all of us, you know, we're all public servants. This enables us to improve the services we provide to the public. It allows us to advocate for meaningful changes, improvements to how we provide services, all that kind of stuff. It makes us much better public workers.
Yeah, because the reason I bring this up is, you know, in my life, we're going through some interesting times. My wife's still in the hospital, and we've gone between hospitals with unionized nurses and hospitals that don't have unionized nurses. And there is a very real difference in the kind of advocacy and the kind of things that you see from the unionized nurses that you don't see in, well, the other places. So for me, that kind of... that union advantage, if you will, is very real in my life. And I see it in other places where people feel empowered to do what they think is best, what they think is right, and to do the best job they can without fear of someone always being over their shoulder. So I think that for me, when I hear you talk about this, that's where my mind goes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it allows us, you know, as employees to, you know, when we see something that needs to be improved, to stand up for making it better without fear that, you know, somehow that is going to have repercussions for your job. Another part of that too is, you know, Boulder County has a large Spanish-speaking population. Many of our workers are bilingual. And one of our goals is to make bilingual pay more equitable. People who are using these skills on a daily basis and are doing extra work by, you know, a caseworker goes to someone's house, does their work in Spanish, goes home, translates their notes into English. That extra work of speaking another language, of translating your notes, we really are going to push for a more equitable compensation for the people doing that kind of work here.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, providing that service that is so essential.
So for our audience in Colorado, what's with this new law, this collective bargaining act, what's the message to them you guys are sending?
The message is, you know, it's not only possible, but it's a great thing to organize and, you know, get your voice at the bargaining table at work and to get that, you know, I can tell you, I've worked in unionized and non-unionized workplaces. The quality of my work life, when I get to be part of a union, the feeling of solidarity, the knowing that someone has my back, knowing I have my coworkers' backs in a way that has this structure of support behind it. It's such a light that kind of comes into your work life. Yeah. I hope all the other counties of our size, 7,500 people or more, will join.
I hope so as well. And also, I think you hit on something that grabbed my attention, you know, having that sense of security, of knowing that, you know, you can't be, you know, just discarded without cause, which we're going to see a want at the federal level. I think it's so important. But Catherine Lehman, I appreciate you taking a couple of minutes for us, sharing your victory with us. And I wish you guys and the folks of Colorado the best.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You think this is something that could go in other states where, you know, we encourage collective bargaining, where we give people the ability to exercise their vote, their right to organize? I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1849. That was the birthday of U.S. labor leader Terence Powderly. Powderly was born the second youngest of 12 children to Irish immigrants in Carbondale, Pennsylvania. At the age of 14, he went to work for the Delaware and Hudson Railroad. In 1871, he joined the International Union of Machinists and Blacksmiths. Also involved in local politics, he was elected mayor of Scranton, Pennsylvania 7 years later. Powderly is most well known for his leadership of the Knights of Labor. The Knights of Labor were a new kind of U.S. labor union in the late 1880s. They invited workers to join regardless of their trade or skill. They helped to lead the fight for the 8-hour day. In his autobiography, Powderly described why he was so committed to the labor movement, writing, 5 men in the country controlled the chief interests of 500,000 working men and can at any moment take the means of livelihood from 2.5 million souls. The goal of the Knights of Labor was to give voice to those 500,000 souls. By 1879, Powderly rose to become the Grand Master Workman, the highest leader of the Knights. Powderly was weary of strikes as a tactic for labor. Yet, despite these personal qualms, the Knights led several successful strikes under his leadership, including one against railroad tycoon Jay Gould. The Knights grew to represent 700,000 workers across the nation. But then, the Haymarket tragedy occurred when a bomb was thrown by an unknown assailant at a workers' rally in Chicago in 1886. In the aftermath of Haymarket, there was a national backlash against labor unions. The Knights bore the brunt as membership dropped by nearly 90%. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So just talking with Catherine Lehman about their big organizing victory in Boulder, Colorado. And look, Colorado seems to be the hotbed of labor activity as you're seeing people, you know, even in this new era of Trump saying, look, we want better wages, hours, conditions. We want better opportunities for ourselves, our children, the future. We want a say at work. We want a lot of the things that my grandparents' generation built and that we've kind of taken for granted over the years. Saying, no, it's about time we go back and do this. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on in Denver, I've asked Jade Kelly to come talk with us. Jade is, am I getting this right, a model, an icon, a member of the university staff at Colorado University Boulder, also president of CWA Local 7799. Jade, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely, and thank you for not abbreviating my all my titles. Model, icon, president. It's a lot I'm carrying under my belt, and I appreciate it.
It's an important task to be a model and an icon, as well as the president of someone out there championing workers' rights. So tell me, what's going on in Denver? We heard what was going on in Boulder. What's going on in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, so, you know, we just won in Boulder, as Catherine shared, and, you know, I think it's really a shining example of how when workers are band together to demand recognition and a collective voice, even in a city like Boulder that has, you know, often actively fought against any policies or practices that protect workers, increasing any wages or meaningfully better our lives as working people, that we can fight and we can win. And these wins prove that when workers organize, we don't just change our workplaces, we change history. And so we just won in Boulder, but just a couple of months ago, we won in Denver. And I think it really shows how worker power isn't built in these silos, but it's a momentum, and that we can really build worker power across coalitions. So with CWA Local 7799, it's not just one union, but a collection of unions. We have UCW Colorado, a union for faculty, staff, graduate, and undergraduate workers at CU at all four campuses in Boulder, Denver, Colorado Springs, Anschutz, as well up at North and South in Colorado State University. We also have five other unions, UC Health Workers United, Denver Health Workers United, Denver Public Library Workers United, Pikes Peak Library Workers United, and the Defenders Union of Colorado. And I think one thing we saw was all of us coming together, we can pass big change, even when we don't have strong labor laws for the public sector here in Colorado. And what we did in Denver is we passed Denver Collective Bargaining, and it's the strongest version of collective bargaining in the state. Includes things like strike rights, doesn't limit what workers are allowed to bargain on. And the best part is voters approved it 2-1. They showed that the public support for collective bargaining is a fundamental right, and that unions are popular. Democrats, independents, Republicans all voted for this measure. Yeah. And really showed that unions can win.
No, as I've been saying for a long time, if you want to reunite this country, reunionize it. Give people the ability to fight for wages, hours, conditions to make their lives better. That's a unifying thing. That's something that moves us forward. And look, you know, Republicans, Democrats, the people who are angry have a reason to be angry. We've been getting screwed for 40 years of bad policy, bad trade deals, all of this stuff. You know, it'd be nice to have someone fighting on our side for a change. But, you know, I look at what you just said here ago. You said a second ago, this Denver collective bargaining thing, you went, took it straight to the voters. How did you do that when most laws emanate out of the state legislature?
Yeah, well, we did a two-path approach because we really wanted to make sure that we, you know, got the strongest version we could. And so we introduced both a proposal in the city council, as well as did signature collection for to make sure that we got this on the ballot. And doing that in Denver is really difficult. But I think doing that two-prong approach did really two different things. One, it allowed us to go to different city council members, to the mayor, and say, well, you know, we don't have to accept your deal. We have this signature collection on this other side. But then it also allowed them to really get behind this because they didn't want to miss out on a big win like this. And so it not only gave us a ton of leverage, but it really brought in allies that we might not have otherwise gotten. And not only did we get our version of collective bargaining passed through the city council, but we got a unanimous vote, which is honestly unheard of, especially when it comes to labor rights, especially when it comes to public sector labor rights in the state of Colorado. It was a huge win. And I think it shows just some of the power we've been able to build in just four short years.
Yeah, especially in this day, Jade, where you've got a guy running who ran for president and is now sitting in the Oval Office, who ran on abusing federal workers, who ran on, you know, firing federal workers and public worker. So, you know, to me, this is good news because, you know, maybe the narrative that's being spun out there is not correct.
Yeah. And I think it shows that Donald Trump is not the only one with power. We built CWA Local 7799 for this moment, to withstand an anti-union president, to stand united against oligarchs with unlimited access to capital, to show that true power rests with the workers who recognize our own power comes with solidarity with each other, to love one another, and to demand justice for an entire community. And, you know, Trump may have championed policies for favoring wealthy and well-connected, but our union shows that real democracy starts in the workplace. Every election we win, every worker we organize is a step towards dismantling that oligarchy.
Now, diversity is going to be an ugly word here for the next 4 years. But, you know, as we were talking during the break, you had mentioned how diverse your membership is. You're talking about doctors. You're talking about lawyers. You're talking about, you know, people who answer phones. You're talking about a wide array of working people. And I know we love to divide ourselves into middle class or, you know, upper whatever. But if you punch a clock and you earn a paycheck, you're a working class person. And that kind of solidarity from doctors on down to dishwashers, I think, is an important thing to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, as you mentioned, we've organized across healthcare. We've organized across higher education, across public libraries, public defenders, and now county workers. And it shows that we can move past these arbitrary job classifications that have largely been used to divide us. And we see ourselves as public sector workers. And even more than that, we're public sector workers who fight for the public good of our community. Our union doesn't just fight for our members. We fight for everyone in our community we serve. Better wages and better working conditions leads to higher quality services for our patients, patrons, students, and clients. We've seen that smaller class sizes leads to better education for our students, or a fully staffed hospital correlates strongly with better patient outcomes. Supporting unions means supporting your neighbor, your community, and yourself. And to your point about diversity, CWA Local 7799 places anti-racism, queer liberation, human rights, and fully funding our public institutions at the core mission, because justice in our workplace means justice in our community. And any good labor union understands this and knows that things like misogyny, racism, and transphobia are tools used by the boss to divide us. And we're not going to fall for it. We're going to continue to build mass worker-led unions across the state.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the division from the bosses. You know, I always use the Jay Gould quote of, you know, the railroad magnate from the 1880s and 1890s, who said, "I could easily pay half the working class to murder the other half." And sadly, they're not even paying anymore. We seem to be doing it to ourselves through these kind of arbitrary divisions. Do you see an opportunity coming in the next months, years, where what you've done in Denver and across Colorado, that maybe spreads across the country, where we're starting to localize labor organizing and localize this kind of solidarity once again, like we did, you know, I don't know, 100 years ago?
Absolutely. I think we've seen a new, growing, revitalized labor movement here in Colorado, and it's because we have moved past just, and not that it's not important, but just moving past just like getting a raise or just about wages. But we're really about fighting for the public good, and we're bringing in the community. We're going to churches. We're going to the drag bar. We're going to places where people are at, and really building that whole worker organizing model that is really we saw succeed in the 30s. And it's interesting that you keep going back to it, because we really do the same thing, even though you know, we have been a more robust union, mostly organizing through Zoom, founded during COVID. We saw that, you know, in the 1930s, the height of worker power in this country was when they just had a spreadsheet of all the workers in their workplace, and they went and talked to each and every one of them. And we build that into our core, that every single member is an organizer, that they are responsible and empowered for building their union. And the only way to do that is to convince their coworkers to join, to stand up, to fight for dignity and fair wages and union recognition. And that same fight that existed in the 1930s, the same fight that fought that Dr. King's final campaign happened before his assassination, where he stood with striking sanitation municipal workers in Memphis, Tennessee, is the same one we see today, where we're fighting for strong unions for public sector workers in Boulder County Employees Union, especially with our big win this past Friday.
No, we were fighting for dignity, respect, and you know, decent wages, hours, and conditions. It doesn't get more complicated than that. But Jade, I appreciate you coming on, sharing some thoughts with us. Congratulations, great work. Keep it up. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as you reunite the world.
Right back at you. And thank you for having us on. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. And it's great to talk to a model and an icon at that. Jade Kelly, thanks so much. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you think this is something that can be replicated? Do you think other states, now that you've got someone in the Oval Office hell-bent on destroying organized labor, do you think this then trickles down into the state and local level? Do you think we do what, say, Illinois did with their Workplace Protection Act? Do you think this can happen in your state? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast, or if you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Freespeech.org. Check that out as well. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Some 54,000 people in the mountains north of Los Angeles are under evacuation orders or warnings due to a new rapidly spreading wildfire, according to this Castaic resident.
I was in a meeting, and within 10 minutes, it went to from like 500 to like 3,000 acres, so it went quick.
The Hughes fire has now spread to over 9,000 acres. CBS News Los Angeles's Amanda Sarantino has been watching the firefighting efforts.
So those water-dropping aircraft are starting to come into the area. We have several ordered for this area. Hand crews on scene, too. Engines are going through. They are working very quickly to get all hands on deck here.
L.A. County Sheriff Robert Luna.
It is critical that people are paying attention and they're ready to leave with no hesitation.
A half dozen states from Louisiana to the Carolinas remain under states of emergency from the historically cold and snowy weather. At least